You're listening to the Locked In Podcast. Here's your host, Algernon Cash.
I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. Welcome back. I always say I've got an exciting show. I know y'all get tired of hearing that. I say that every week. But this show really, really, really is exciting. I'm so excited about my guest today. Before I get into that, you know, I always like to pause and make sure we thank our subscribers because all the content that I produce is free. We just want good, strong, factual, logical content out there that you can learn from and become more aware about what's happening in your backyard. We don't charge you for the content, but there is someone paying for the content, and that's the subscribers of the Locked In community. And I always like to thank them. And if you want to become a subscriber, shoot me a message. I'll tell you how you can sign up. It's really affordable. And again, it helps support the content that we're providing for free. In addition, one thing that you can do, if you're watching this on a social media channel, one way you can support me that doesn't cost anything, you can click like, you can click share, you can let a friend know what you heard, and invite them to be locked in on the next episode. So I really appreciate that. So, let's kick into the show. I've got a really great friend, old friend. I know I always say every week I've got a great friend, but this is a really great friend, original friend, old friend, Bron Sims. Back when I was doing Community Focus with Renee Vaughn on 97.1. That's right, man. That's right. Big shout out to Renee. Bron used to come on and we used to debate and we used to spar. And I tell you, I learned so much from those conversations. I think you're getting ready to learn a lot from this conversation. Bron is a psychology professor at FAMU, also a consultant in the education management space. But then all around, I think what you're getting ready to learn over the next several minutes is he's a really smart, talented guy, knows his stuff. And I think he's going to bless you with some words this morning. So, Bron, what's going on, man? How are you?
Man, appreciate you bringing me into the Locked In community. I was not, as you mentioned, been too long. True OGs. I remember rocking back way back in, quote unquote, back in the day. Good to see you and the success and the continuity that you've had in leadership and thought, productivity and community engagement. So let me just publicly applaud you for the work that you've been doing all these years, brother. Good to reconnect.
Man, I appreciate it. I miss those Sunday mornings. It was early, man. We'd be in the studio at 6 a.m. going at it. We were young men. I don't think I can do it anymore, man. I don't think I can get up that early that in the morning and think that well at the same time.
And I don't, honestly, I'd love to go back through some of the archives. I don't know how much of that stuff that I was saying back then I'd stand by right now, but, you know, certainly good to build a basis and, you know, evolution and change and growth. So, yeah, just appreciate you having me here.
You know, I'm glad you said that. I think that's a great way to segue into our conversation today, because we were doing some work on my website. We have all the old Community Focus episodes archived there. Wow. My listeners, if you go to lockedin.cash, you can go listen to some of those episodes that are, I mean, I'm talking 10, 11 years old. We were talking about issues back then that you can go check out. And I was listening to some of them. And I was even listening to some of my own commentary and saying to myself how much I disagree with myself. And it was strange, Bron. I was listening to some of the commentary. I was listening to you. I was listening to some of my remarks, and it's funny how you evolve over time, and you don't become a different person, because I think the core of you is the same, but you evolve and your thoughts evolve. And I think that's completely okay. And I want to get your reaction to that, man. I think sometimes people feel like it's not okay to shift your paradigm and your thoughts over time.
No, I think not only is it okay, I think it's evidence of what, you know, folks today are referring to as mental health, right? I mean, everything, you know, I'm really big on the emergent sort of structure reality of all things. In very, very rarely do you find something that just is. Life itself is a cycle. It's a process. It involves change, growth, maturation. So if you find an individual or an organization, for that matter, that is doing exactly the same thing today that they were doing yesterday, it's probably evidence of some level of stagnation and death. What you hope for, you know, for us in terms of like individuals, how we approach the world, as you were saying, what we think, right? For those things to change. We're always encountering new information. We're always having new experiences. And if that those new experiences and information and such aren't impacting how you view reality, then I would say something is very wrong. So the idea, yeah, like you said, of growth and change, I mean, in our relationships, in our personal outlook, you know, that is, I think that's necessary.
You know, and I, you know, I'm a big political junkie, and it feels like when you look at politics, that's one space where politicians feel like they can't evolve. So, right. You know, the same position I had 20 years ago on gun control or criminal justice or what, you know, you pick your favorite issue. It's the same position I need to have today. And I think that's so short-sighted. I do think you evolve and you become better. And circumstances change. Some of the things that are happening today around take guns, for example, wasn't happening before. And so we have to evolve and make sure we take a new look and shift our paradigm. You know, I brought up politics, man. We're not going to debate today. So we're not going to give that show to my audience. You got to go back and listen to the archives to hear Brian and I spar. But I do, man, we talked a lot about politics back in the day. I'm really curious. I haven't had a political conversation with you in a long time. What's your current thoughts about politics? We just came out of the Trump era. I think back when you and I were talking, Barack Obama was just being elected. So that was probably back around 2009. Yep. And so he did two terms. We went through the Trump era and now we're in the Biden era. What are your thoughts about the political landscape?
So, you know, can't really speak to, like I said, what I was saying back then. I know I've always been anchored and focused on the, you know, at the end of the day, impact for African people. And, you know, I think that to your point around how politics and politicians have difficulty in evolving and acknowledging failures and short sights in their positions or platforms and being inclusive of other people's ideas. You know, I think that's still pretty much the position of, you know, Black folks in America and in other places around the world to the political structures. I don't see a lot of, you know, so-called politics, whether they be electoral politics or any other sort of like political formations, organizations, et cetera, really meaningfully doing anything about the basic fundamental realities of you know, white domination in Black oppression. So you're right. We haven't spoken through like most of Obama, all of Trump, and now any of Biden. But I would say if we look at the data, I would bet Black folks are still pretty much in the same position, if not worse, today in 2021 than they were way back in 2008. So I'm always big with my students. Don't be fooled by like personality. Don't be fooled by the appearances of what's happening from a political standpoint. You got to talk about basic questions of power. You got to talk about basic questions of self-determination and people's ability to determine their lives for themselves. And I'm not aware of any major sort of changes or shifts in that conversation as it relates to Black folks.
You go back to 2008. I'll go back even longer or further. If you look at the income gap, wealth gap, home ownership gap, and education gaps in the Black community compared to the white counterparts, we're still at 50-year levels. So in other words, in percentage terms, now the real numbers may have changed, but in percentage terms, we've not seen any change in those gaps in 50 years. So that means the average Black family household wealth is about 10% of their white counterpart. And I think you're right. It's beyond time that we've got to address some of these issues. And, you know, one thing that I launched here recently, Brian, that you know, I'm going to be calling on you and trying to pick your brain and bounce ideas off of you. We've launched the Black Empowerment Network. And, you know, we are advocating for those issues and policies that we just talked about. And one thing I've told people is that, you know, I didn't create the network so that we can just have more conversations or more roundtables or commission more research studies because we've already studied the issue. We know what the issue is. We even know what the solutions are. We just have not worked up the courage and the will and took the action behind them. And so that's what we're trying to do through our Empowerment Network. We've been very fortunate to recruit a great leadership committee across North Carolina. And it's going to take a lot of work. I'm not naive and fooling myself. This isn't going to be something where you blink your eyes and we're all of a sudden out of this issue. It took us 50 years to work into it. It may take us 50 more years to work out of it, as is what my grandfather would probably say. So, you know, another issue that we haven't really seen change, you know, stand on this conversation about race. You know, I still remember being 10 or 11 years old back in the early 90s when the L.A. riots happened as a result of the Rodney King police beating. And I was really young, so it was really hard to understand exactly what was going on and how to interpret everything. But you stand there and you watch what was happening on the news, and clearly, you know, it's not right. Right. Like you're old enough to know whatever you're watching that this is not right. So you fast forward to 2020, May 2020. And I can recall watching the video of George Floyd with the police officer's knee on his neck. And I had the same feeling that I had back when I was 10 or 11 years old, saying, OK, this just isn't right. So, you know, Brian, it feels like we're stuck on Groundhog's Day when it comes to Black folks' interaction with the police. And I want to say this because I've probably got some police officers and law enforcement that listen to my show and they're part of my audience. I have a lot of respect for law enforcement, and probably 98% of y'all get it right. Right. But it's that 2% of the time that casts that long shadow over the entire community. So it's like the pilot, right? Like if I land it right 99% of the time, but it's that 1% of the time that I don't land the plane right, most likely that's what we're going to be talking about is when I get it wrong. So, I mean, what are your thoughts, man? I mean, why are we not seeing any changes in these images that we keep seeing across our screen?
Yeah, that's actually kind of an easy question for me. Just as a psychologist, I think we're very comfortable with thinking about, you know, personality and intelligence and attitude and all these different other psychological variables as individual constructs. So we're very comfortable seeing differences between person A and person B. And that's what comes to the forefront when we think about, you know, societal level issues and problems like what you're talking about, the systematic killing of African people at the hands of law enforcement. So the easy answer is, let's not even talk about it at the individual level. Let's talk about it at a systems level. I can agree that the overwhelming majority of people involved in law enforcement and in the criminal justice system as a whole are probably moral, well-intentioned individuals who, you know, have been raised right and want to do the best not only for themselves, but society in general. Absolutely. But where we see the intersection of people, Black folks in law enforcement, literally getting, you know, eliminated, I don't think that that's an individual or personality issue. I don't think it's going to be solved by remediation or by minimizing or by, you know, body cams or community policing panels, because what we're not talking about, in my view, is the bad apples, the individuals who, like, as you mentioned, are in the 1 or 2%. I don't think that's the issue. I think what we have with the police, the impact of the police in terms of Black death in the Black community is a historically systematic phenomenon. It has never not been there. Before there was police, there was white militarized armed individuals who came into Black communities and execute this. I mean, that's a historical fact. So to your point about Groundhog's Day, that's what we would expect if we were talking about a cyclical, systematic, you know, predictable phenomenon, but not what we would expect if we were trying to figure out, are you a good police officer? Is this a good community? Those sorts of questions. So I guess my short answer is, let's not make the mistake of putting a individual mask on a collective, systematic sort of problem or issue.
So what is that solution? I heard you mention, and you're right. I mean, when these, I don't want to call them incidents. I think they actually, that word probably minimizes what's really happening. But when we see this activity, the natural reaction is to say a lot of what you just said. So, hey, let's look at community policing, more body cams, more training, better recruitment. You hear these things that people propose. I hear you saying you wouldn't necessarily. You don't think those things are going to solve the issue. What does solve the issue? I mean, how do we reimagine policing then?
Yeah, good question. I'm going to take the easy out. As an academic, I'm good at the questions. I'm not great at the answers. So I totally acknowledge, like you said, around like not being naive. It's not a simple route to dealing with, you know, 400, almost 500 years of systematic oppression. It's not an easy thing to talk about the ingrained attitudes and values of white supremacy. So what I'm not suggesting is we can snap our fingers and do something, you know, categorical about it overnight. But I do think understanding the problem is relatively straightforward. I think what is interesting, I'll add another question and not give you an answer. What I would ask is, when does America as a system of systems, when does America start to address the other side of these equations? Because you and I, when we see, you know, the next brother or sister or child, right, black brother, sister, child murdered in the street at the hands of law enforcement, our response is what you just described. It's outrage. It's horror. This is like, oh my God. But that's not the unilateral response on the part of America. You have many Americans who take a whole different response pattern. So my question in response to your question is, when does America actually do like address that? You see what I'm saying? Like right now, this trial that's going on in Minneapolis, not everybody is saying like that was, his knee was on his neck for how many, like this is unbelievable. There are many people who are like, well, you know, this is, so, you know, I think that's to my point around the system. People generally are very very slow or hesitant to want to change systems that benefit them. And I think you can see that reflected in the fact that you get a very polarized response to each and every one of these incidents. If this were a clear question of race and white supremacy, then there wouldn't be people who are like defending the police officers or arguing that, you know, it was really the fault of the victim, or, you know, elongated trials over when there's clear video about what's happening. I think those things would not be present if we lived in a system where there was a clear consensus about what needs to happen and what the future should be. I think there are many folks in America who would love to have the same systems of white power, privilege, and supremacy continue on for the next 20, 30, 50, 100 years. And that's not everyone, but I do think that element is here. And I feel like their visibility is part of what's making this such a highly, you know, public or publicity sort of standpoint. Because these killings, as I already mentioned, they've been happening. This is not like black people have started dying at the hands of cops.
Well, yeah. And I you know, obviously Rodney King wasn't killed, but I cite that as probably you know, what I think everybody has a milestone moment when they come in the reality of what's going on. And that was a milestone moment for me you know, in my life. And I'm sure other people have other milestone moments based on your age. And, you know, if you came through the 60s, your milestone moments are going to be much more horrific than what I saw in the early 90s with Rodney King. You probably saw somebody get killed. I do think you're right. I mean, there's a strong emotional reaction anytime we see these kind of cases happen. I think it each one of these cases tend to be a little bit different, and you sort of got to dissect them. I don't think, you know, the George Floyd case was so egregious, in my opinion. You if you're watching that video for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, and you're watching this man on the ground repeatedly tell you that he can't breathe, repeatedly say that I'm scared that I'm going to die, and this officer does not let up. He's at this point, he's not even resisting for several minutes of the video. In fact, he's not even really moving. Ooh. And I don't see how anybody can watch that video and not be moved emotionally to say, okay, hey, this is wrong. This is not right in any kind of shape, fashion, or form. Recently, the same thing happened again, at least for me. There was a black army officer who was pulled over in Windsor, Virginia. He was accused of evading arrest. That he was trying to get away from the police. When the police did pull him over, he has his hands up high the entire time. He tells them clearly that I'm scared. Will you take my seatbelt off? Will you open my door? I don't want to move my hands. And you know, he's not resisting. He's not doing any of these things. And he still gets pepper sprayed. And he's in his uniform. He's in his actual army uniform, and he's a lieutenant in the army in an area where there's a bunch of army bases. And you watch this, and Brian, man, I watched it probably a dozen times when I first saw the video, and I sent it to a friend of mine who's a former prosecutor, and he has a lot of experience analyzing this body cam. And I said, man, you know, tell me, what do you think about this? And he said, this is absolutely horrific. And it's highly egregious. And it's like, you know, when we're told that, hey, what you should do if you fear your life, you should, you know, go to a well-lit area, keep your hands up high, communicate clearly to the officer. If you do these things, then you shouldn't have these kind of interactions with the police. And this young brother did all those things and still, got a face full of pepper spray. And really, in my opinion, got really disrespected considering that he serves this country. And so, you know, I think people see that and they don't know how to react to it. But I hear what you're saying, man. We've got to have a real shift in how people see these incidents and how they receive them. And I think it's creating a tremendous amount of fear. I saw another video. I'd love to get you to react to this, where there was a husband and wife. A white man pulled a gun on the wife, on the black woman. The husband subdues the gunman, and the black woman is actually afraid to call the police because she's afraid if she calls the police, they're going to rush in and kill her husband. So, Brian, if we're living in an environment where now, and you're around students, you're in the classroom, like, what are your students saying? What is their perception? And I'm assuming you're at FAMU, you probably got a predominantly African-American class. What's their perception of police right now?
Yeah, I saw that Virginia video, and I just, when you were talking, it made me think about something one of my mentors, Dr. Kobe Cambon, always tried to impress. As black psychologists, you know, psychology is a discipline, social science, where the goal is to sort of be able to predict behavior. And one of the things he always used to say to me was, it's fascinating how as you know, black folks, people of African descent, the maneuvers and behaviors of the dominant system of Europeans, white Americans, always seems to confuse us, even though they basically play by the same game plan. So, you know, tomorrow there'll be some famous person on the airwaves using the N-word. And after that, there'll be, you know, it's like we're shocked and surprised and amazed every single time, even though the same thing literally keeps happening over and over and over again. I was just thinking about that as you were talking about watching that video, because you're right. That Virginia video with the pepper spray was one of the clearest, you know, in my mind, illustrations of this is not about interpersonal dynamics. I mean, if a black man in military uniform who is clearly hands up and talking calmly to the officers can still get physically assaulted, like, there is not anything that we could do. So, you know, it's your question about like how the next generation or young folks in college classrooms are viewing police these days. You know, I think there's a lot of trepidation. I think there's a lot of anxiety, and that notion of like, we're not going to call the police no matter what, because we know what's happening. I don't happen to see that as a problematic response. I happen to see that as clear, critical thinking in service of your survival, because what happens when the police show up, all of bets are off in terms of like who's going to get protected and who's going to get violent. So, you know, it's a good question. I don't really have any data. Anecdotally, I think though that students are becoming more aware of these issues than perhaps in like our college generations. I don't think police brutality was as highly visible back then. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but I don't think that it was as on the forefront because of your, you know, I mean, you mentioned George Floyd. We can, again, blast from the past. Let's talk Oscar Grant. Let's talk Amadou Diallo. You know, let's talk George Bell. I mean, the list of brothers and sisters and children that have gotten murdered while they're literally got their hands up, you know, it's too long for us to list right now. So anyway, I think it's more visible. I'm not quite sure about what the psychological reaction. I do think there's a very clear effort on the part of police formations to try to be more community engaged. And so you're seeing on social media, like videos of police and other law enforcement officials, like in community situations, handing things out. I saw one the other day, this, you know, police officer gave this kid some Steph Curry shoes on social. I mean, you're seeing more of that. I don't really have a remark on that, but how college kids are taking it is I'm not that sure.
Yeah, I think police are trying to be more proactive. I've had some conversations with the Police Benevolent Association. I think they are trying to be way more proactive in terms of using tools like social media. You may see police officers in communities now playing basketball with kids and, you know, getting on TikTok and and doing some of that. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I actually think that's probably a good thing. And maybe they will experience and see some things that they wouldn't have seen otherwise. And maybe, you know, the gravity of the moment has finally brought them to open in their hearts up. And hopefully it's not something that's being done as a PR move solely.
Right.
You know, everything's a PR move to some degree, but hopefully they're actually getting some value out of it. And to your point, man, I think a lot of these interactions have been going on for quite some time. I think really what's happened is social media and these little small everybody's walking around here. They're a news journalist now, right? Because everybody's got a camera. And so I think it's just much more in our face. It's not just on the big screen like Rodney King was, but it's on our small screens. And it's to the point, like Martin Luther King talked about in the 60s, who I'm a huge fan of, it's gotten to the point that it's so in your face that you can't ignore it. You see it everywhere. And I think that's why you've seen so many people finally standing up and saying, hey, you know, this is something that we've got to do. You see a lot of corporations and major sporting leagues and others saying, you know, becoming more socially conscious. Now, I question whether or not some of that's being motivated by dollars, right? You know, these are corporations. But I think it's good that they are certainly putting that message out there. Before I run out of time, man, you're a hip hop guy. I'm a 90s baby. I love hip hop. We just lost a legend. DMX died at age 50. And as most people know, DMX struggled with substance abuse throughout his career, throughout most of his life. And I put up a post, Brian, and I told people, you know, here's a man that was filled with so much pain, but yet found a way to share so much love. And I would encourage any of my audience to go on YouTube, search DMX, search Breakfast Club. I mean, there's so many powerful interviews that he gave that will really move you. I mean, I spent really almost an entire day this past Sunday just watching these things. And it really sewed into my spirit, man. But it also made me think that we are beyond the point where we must stop we must decriminalize substance abuse and really start treating it as what it is, which is a mental health issue. We've got to stop just locking people up because they use drugs. I mean, they're obviously suffering from some kind of an issue. When you heard about DMX, man, how did that hit you, man? What was your reaction when you heard about his passing? 50, man, I'm 41. So that, you know, he's only 9 years older than me.
Yeah, no, same. I'll be 42 this year. When I got the call, it was very sobering. You know, I think one of the things that's different, I mean, and we've, you know, I'm not real big on the notion of like a hip hop community, but in the music industry, what we refer to as hip hop in general, we lost several crucial figures over the last, you know, umpteen years. And so, you know, one of the things I think that was a little bit different about this experience in terms of the tragic loss of a legend and an amazing figure was that it was sort of expected or anticipated, or at least gradual, you know, because he had the prolonged hospital situation before actually transitioning. And, you know, I actually give thanks for that, because I think what part of what DMX's legacy will be for future generations that may not necessarily even engage his music will be the ability for people to come together and acknowledge some of the things that you just said before he was actually gone. Many of us are taken out overnight and there's no warning. There's no ability to prepare. Many people were basically, you know, I don't know if you can be prepared, but in that space of like, wow, we might lose DMX, and showed a lot of love, not just to him and the family, but also to other people through their connections with his music over the years. So, you know, I hope that that'll actually be part of his legacy, not just his success and the millions of albums that he sold and the movies that he made, but in his ability to, when we start to thinking about like, wow, maybe this might be our loss of this figure, what that does to how we connect to each other. And that's what I saw a lot of, Algernon. I saw a lot of people talking and telling stories about the DMX songs or the movies that they saw, and literally using that situation, like you said, of substance abuse and life lost too soon, as an ability to connect with each other. So I kind of just try to give thanks for that, you know, without having known him personally or really been a huge fan. I have a lot of respect for his talent, And like you said, his conviction. But you know, it wasn't so much a personal emotional loss. It was more of a let's give thanks because he had an ability even in death to bring Black folks together.
You've been listening to the voice of Brian Sims, a psychology professor at FAMU, also a education management consultant and an OG, one of my old friends, man. And I encourage again, once again, I encourage my audience, go to lockedin.cash. You're going to have to scroll back now. You're going to have to go all the way back to 2009. You'll see a show called Community Focus, and you can listen to some other conversations that Brian and I used to have on Sunday morning on that show. I will tell you that it wasn't as calm as the discussion that you just listened to today. We used to go at each other's neck. But you know, we all get a little older and we get a little wiser. And I'm glad to still call you a friend, Brian. Thank you for coming on the show. You know, I got to have you back. I'm putting you in the regular rotation. So anytime you want to come on and get a message out, man, I'm here. You just let me know. We'd love to have you back anytime. Okay.
Appreciate the opportunity, man. We'll be in touch.
Man, I appreciate you locking in. Y'all have been locked in too. Again, go find me on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. Check out the YouTube channel. If you're listening into this on radio and you want a friend to hear it, you can also download the podcast. I'm on Apple, Spotify, Pandora. Cash is everywhere. All the places you get your favorite podcast episodes. Make sure you go subscribe to Locked In with Algernon Cash. And until next week, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WCG. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. The views and opinions in this podcast are solely those of the contributors and are not necessarily those of our distributors or hosting company. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.